Okay, this is continuing with Hugo von Worden on 29th November 1973. Right.
So, the one important result of this work in the Galactic Center was to show the true nature and location of the radio source Sagittarius A. The other is sort of the mirror image of it. The hydrogen in front of it, which was seen in absorption, with velocities of 53 kilometers a second minus, could only be interpreted as a structure which was moving towards the Sun with that high velocity, and therefore moving away from the galactic center with such high speed. And then also from the observations it was clear that there were other structures with even higher negative velocities also seen in absorption, and therefore moving away from the center at even greater speeds.
And this is an entirely new phenomenon.
Entirely new. Nothing of that sort was known. Also, hydrogen with high positive velocities was seen at the galactic center, but not in absorption. So the overall picture from that was that in the inner parts of the galactic system, there were systematic motions of gas away from the center, which suggested some explosive phenomenon. A theory of why this was happening, we could not make available, and in fact it's not yet available at this time. But we thought that these two results were of such importance that we should ventilate them as fast as possible. So Oort asked me to write a paper, and he suggested that we should send it to the compte rendu of the Académie des Sciences de Paris, where he had just become a corresponding member.
Nice.
So I wrote that paper in French.
That's the only time you've had to do that, I guess.
I think it's the only paper I ever wrote in French. And it took me just one night to write it, as I remember. And then Wim Rauchor, who had been sharing in the observations with me in January 57, when we took the second lot, was a co-author. And then I suggested to Oort that he might also be a co-author. He thought it was unnecessary, but then we found out that the paper was rather longer than permitted. And then we thought it was rather better that we had a third author, because that justified an extra page.
I see. So originally he wasn't going to be the
co-author. He said no, but of course he had the original initiative, and he had contributed to the interpretation, so it was fully justified.
Just let me ask a quite unrelated question about hydrogen absorption. As you undoubtedly are familiar, the first results obtained at NRL was a short paper in APJ, and they had the interpretation all wrong. They thought the hydrogen was behind the source.
Yes.
Can you just comment on that? I mean, when you saw this paper, I mean, it must have been rather unbelievable to someone that was astrophysically
Let's see, that paper came out in
54.
It came out at the time that I was in South Africa. And
so you, that's right, you weren't part of that. Yeah.
I was not in radio astronomy then, and I'm not sure that I have caught that paper in due time.
Hmm.
In fact, my first hearing about the 21 centimeter absorption was when I visited Oort after returning from South Africa in late 54, and he told me that for a few radio sources their position with respect to the spiral arms in the galaxy had been determined.
Yeah.
Cas A and Cygnus A.
That was done in Jodrell, actually, by Williams and Davies, who had the right interpretation. And NRL corrected itself quickly.
Yeah, but I think that what Oort mentioned to me were the new results of NRL, where this location of radio sources with respect to spiral arms had been done.
Well, they did it more accurately, I should say.
Yes.
Jodrell did it first,
certainly
actually.
A better paper. Yeah. And at that time, then, I've understood about this method, which is, of course, very similar to the interstellar absorption line studies.
But you don't... Do you happen to know who had the first idea for this method? It's funny that no one thought about putting it down in black and white in the early days. At least I've never found it as a possibility.
No.
It's not in Wilde's paper, for instance, or...
No, I don't know about that. I don't even know why Hagen started these first observations of the...
Oh, that was accidental.
Accidental. Hmm.
They just saw the signal going down.
Yes.
So they figured the source was blocking the hydrogen.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Of course, they quickly got corrected on that, but...
No, I don't know whether anyone had foreseen this possible use...
It's funny, because...
...before Hagen applied it.
Okay, well, that's a sideline. So, back to Dwingelow observations.
Yes. Now, immediately linking up with this, the number three program that we had was studies of absorption spectra of point sources, which at that time were considered one of the important uses of the hydrogen line. And in particular, not only for galactic location of sources, but to study in detail the properties of the structure and physics of neutral hydrogen in yeah. these so much narrower cones towards a special source. So Müller was planning detailed work on Cassiopeia A as a private project which would really try to show the utmost of what the instrument could do. And during the October run, and probably also in January, we took some observations of Cassiopeia A for this purpose, and also some work on Taurus A. I don't think any other sources, the other Cygnus, Sagittarius, Virgo, Orion, I've done together with Müller in the winter of early winter of 1958, when they were then published together for several sources in the Proceedings of the Paris Symposium in 58.
That first Müller paper was published in APJ, though.
That's in APJ in 57.
That's the only Dutch paper, I think, that's been published in APJ, with maybe a couple others. But do you happen to know the reason why that was?
It's possible that that's the only one. I think it was because it was only a small paper, and BAN was not used in general for small papers, certainly not in radio astronomy. And possibly also APJ was supposed to be faster. Another reason, again, might be that the other work on
right.
on absorption spectra had appeared in APJ.
That could be, yeah.
I haven't heard it discussed why it was done that way, but I can imagine those reasons. Well, then finally, as the fourth program was my own thesis work in associations, which was sort of a low priority at that time, and I got the first set of about 25 profiles, taken rather haphazard through the Orion Association at a number of interesting points. They looked very promising.
You didn't know if there was going to be any hydrogen there at all, really, I guess.
Yes.
You did?
I think I did. Yes, I was quite sure of that, since this was not the first observation of that sort. Kocu Menon was working on a doctor's thesis at Harvard
That's right.
The Orion region. And he had given preliminary results at the Jodl Bank Symposium on Radio Astronomy in the summer of 1955. That was with the Harvard
24-foot,
yeah. So a 2-degree beam. And I was sure I could do it a lot better at Dwingelow, but I knew that there would be something.
Okay, yeah, that's right.
But I found far more detail already in these early observations, including a lovely absorption spectrum on Orion A. When we came back with these 4 weeks of observations, of course, the people at the observatory were quite excited about the results, and Oort wanted me to, maybe expected me to continue the analysis of the galactic center region together with him. But I rather preferred to stick to my original thesis choice on hydrogen in associations and its detailed cloud structure relationships to star formation. So Oort then invited Wim Rauhoor to take over this project, essentially. He was working in variable stars, so he was dragged to Dwingelow.
I see.
And in the second observing run in January 57, I instructed him and we did the observations together. And from then on, he has carried that ball, and of course,
right.
with many quite interesting results. In January, I did the second series of observations on M31 together with Steven van Acht, another graduate student at Leiden at that time. But then later in the following periods, I have stuck to my own program in the associations, essentially. I must say that sometimes later I regretted my stubbornness in a way, because it's become obvious later that the studies in the Galactic Center became much more interesting and carried many more surprises than the work in the associations really did.
It's easy to see now. But
the associations were rather disappointing because the hydrogen structure, although interesting, was rather confusing and did not show very clear relationships to the stellar distribution or to problems of star formation. Probably it was rather too complicated and difficult a subject.
Well, how many different sessions did it take at Winglow for your thesis?
That's been quite a number. Let me try to count.
Just roughly, I mean.
Yes. Well, I had a few dozen profiles in October 56, I had a few dozen in January 57. Then in June 57, we started a 3-month observing period in which we recalibrated the whole telescope first and then set up a solid routine for long observations with a lot of hired students in which I was sort of in charge of the whole lot. And there were several graduate students also, Wim Raupoort, Luca Voldus, who had the extragalactic program then. And I got a lot of scattered observations through the Orion and Scorpius regions at that time. Then there's been a big break in which mostly extragalactic work was done. Then in the summer of 58, we got a new receiver. We got lower noise, better baseline, and 8 channels.
And which is a real improvement. Yeah.
Yes, so we could then make profiles quite fast, even with narrow bands, let us say, in an hour, instead of 3 hours, you could have a profile over three times as long, so over 170 kilometers a second in an hour, with double coverage even. And originally it was over 80 kilometers a second in about 3 hours with only single coverage. So then I decided to restart the whole job and to do a regular grid of observations in Orion, a 1-degree grid, later extended to half-degree grid in some regions.
I see.
And I've kept the old observations, but I've never properly reduced them because there were many problems in the first 2 years with unreliable baselines, erratic behavior of the sensitivity of the channels. There was only one channel, the sensitivity of the receiver. For the observations in 58 and 59, these properties were more consistent. And I was also later able to show that both the variation of zero line and the variation of receiver sensitivity were strongly dependent on the ambient temperature. That was a thing that was first shown by me, just by correlation with the...
I've seen a report on that, I think.
You have, I see. It's in my thesis somewhere. Mm. The temperatures at the Eelde airport were used for the correlation. And the way I discovered it was, I think in December 59, there was a sudden drop in temperature when we got some very sharp frost. And when I was looking at observations, the data about receiver sensitivity, let's say temperature scale of the observations, a number of weeks later, I saw a sudden rise in sensitivity, and I didn't understand why this could happen, until I suddenly remembered that at that particular date, the frost has started.
Yeah.
And so I found that effect, and then I also started looking for an effect on the zero lines, and that was also very obvious. And since then, it's become a routine for the Winglow measurements to apply systematic corrections of that sort.
So you basically repeated it because it was so you could repeat it so fast and get much more reliable data also.
Yes, yes. So that became then a consistent set of observations, better corrected, more complete in a regular grid, quite homogeneous in a relatively short time. There was 2 months observing November 58, December 58, in which I took the whole 1-degree grid in Orion. Later, some measurements were repeated, which were poor. And the half-degree grid was obtained partly in essentially in the spring of 1960.
And in between these sessions, you were working on the reduction.
I was working on the reduction, but also on various other projects. What had happened to me is, in the meantime, that was that in 57, in summer of 57, Blau took up an appointment as professor of astronomy, as the new director of the Kaptein Laboratory at Groningen. And he took it over from Van Rijn, who had retired the year before. And Blau wanted to modernize the institute, of course.
Blau was at Leiden, excuse me?
No. Blau had been, at Leiden after his doctor's degree for 7 years as an associate professor, or lector.
Yeah.
In 53, he went to Yerkes.
That's right.
And was there for 4 years. Although I think at that time he already foresaw that he would be called back for Groningen later. But in 57, he came from Yerkes to Groningen to become director there. And he wanted to modernize the place. So he started Borgman on some modern photometry, narrowband. He had, of course, Plaut, who had started the big Palomar survey for variable stars at the inspiration of Bade. And then he asked me to come to Groningen to start radio astronomy. So I considered that for a few weeks and then decided that I would indeed do it. I brought my Orion material and other stuff with me and could work on that for a thesis at Groningen then. But when I had been there for a couple of months, Blau came with some other ideas. He had been approached by some people from outside whether they could come to work at Groningen, and one or two of these had the wish to be in Holland to learn some radio astronomy. So within a few months after I had started to do my own radio astronomy work at Groningen, I had first a young man from Belgium who had to learn radio astronomy from me. That's Luc Braas, who has later become astronomer at Leiden Observatory. And then a man from Hungary, Dr. Földish, who was an expert in celestial mechanics, but he wanted to learn some radio astronomy, so he worked with me for 2 months. And then in 59...
That's not Fleisch's...
No.
How do you pronounce the other fellow's name?
Földish.
Földish. This is not F-E-J-E-S.
No, it is F-O, two dots, L-D-E-S. He's not known in astronomy, really. He was one of Fayish's teachers,
I see.
And then in 59, Margarita Hack came for a couple of weeks and did some work together with me. And we got Takakubo from Sendai in Japan, who came for 2 years and who has done a lot of work together with me on neutral hydrogen at intermediate latitudes.
How did that happen? The Japanese had only done solar astronomy.
That's true. Well, Takakubo had been interested in interstellar matter and had published a paper which was essentially a reanalysis of the Adams survey along rather similar lines to the work that Blau had done.
I see.
And I think that was his doctor's thesis. And
just in the publications of ASP?
ASJ, right. So he had written to Blau whether he could come to do some work of this sort. Maybe he had written to Van Rijn first. No, he must have written to Blau. He wanted to work with Blau, I think, and then Blau suggested that he might look at interstellar matter with the radio telescope, or at least observations of that.
So he didn't come here to learn radio, really. He just
No, he wanted to do work on interstellar matter. And it's true that Blau had suggested to me that a survey of neutral hydrogen at intermediate latitudes would be a very useful thing with the eight-channel receiver. Right in the first week when I was testing out that new receiver, in fact, I did the testing and calibration of that receiver in 58, Blau suggested that intermediate latitudes would be the proper place to look for evidence of interstellar clouds in profiles. Because at low latitudes, you, of course, you get all the spiral arms, and there are very many clouds which are overlapping, so you can't see them separately.
Right.
And at high latitudes, you'll see only one. But at intermediate latitudes, the profile might just break up into clouds. So we then outlined a survey at intermediate latitudes to study cloud properties and started observations in a little bit in the summer of 58 and then more in the fall of 58 at the same time when I did my survey in Orion. We also did this survey for intermediate latitudes. And Whitney Shane started his work on the inner parts of the galaxy for his thesis. Now, this project then, intermediate latitudes, was carried by me as a sideline, essentially, together with Luc Brass originally, where Brass did some of the deductions, some of the preparations for observations. And then later it was taken over by Tucker Kubo a year later when he came. And by the way, all the reductions for all those observations had to be done by hand. We had no electronic computers available. In fact, until 1961, all the reductions of 21 centimeter line observations through a considerable number of steps had to be done by hand. Reading the charts for intensities and dividing them up into frequency intervals, or velocity intervals, frequencies we did first. Taking out the intensities, correcting them for DC0 level, for non-linearity of the output, taking out the frequency-dependent receiver zero level, correcting for variations in sensitivity of the channels, and for the overall sensitivity of the receiver, correcting for extinction, for continuum radiation, And all that procedure was done in detail and quite accurately.
This was done in the Cypher Tower?
Yes. And we had quite a large number of people working on that. Say, something like four of the administrative technical staff of the observatory, of the institute, were doing readings and calculations of that sort. And at times, helped by a large number of vet students, I started out with three in the beginning of 59, and there have been times where I had as many as 10. And so much of that time I was just a director of personnel, telling all these people what to do and then checking on their results.
Right.
And I used the day hours to chase them and the night hours to correct them and to plan the next day.
While we're on this subject, you mentioned observatory, but why did this Kronecker never call it an observatory, rather a laboratory?
It was started really as a laboratory by Kopteng. He just had a couple of rooms with some measuring instruments to do counts and measures on photographic plates, which he got from the Cape, from Hamburg, and from other places. And Van Rijn only, around 1930 or 35, started having a telescope.
I see.
And then they did not rename the laboratory. It had indeed already been named after Kapteyn Astronomical Laboratory, by Van Rijn. And they kept the name that way. And an observatory was only founded when Blau had come. It was decided after one or two years that we wanted to have a good telescope, which then should be outside the city in order to avoid the lights.
Mm.
And that is how the Kapteyn Sterwachter Drode originated.
Okay.
But well, that's no radio story.
No, I was just wondering about that.
Yeah.
So where were we? Well, I guess the point was that this business on the intermediate latitude clouds detracted from your thesis.
That's very true. Also, although I was still working on my own thesis, I served as an instructor for various foreign astronomers who wanted to learn radio astronomy. And at least with me, it was natural that guests who would be there for a few weeks or months or only 2 years had priority over my own interests because they had limited right. time.
You had no grant that was running out to...
No, I had a,
as happens nowadays.
I had a junior staff position.
Yeah.
And I was more or less certain that I could continue as long as yeah. was needed.
But so when did it finally get finished?
And my doctor's thesis was finished in July 62, 7 years after my doctorandus, or 6 years really after I started working on it. And I must say that the date of, I think, 6 July had been set in February. At that time, nothing was written yet, but an enormous amount of graphs and of calculations were available. I continued doing things of that sort for quite some time. And I guess I started writing in May, and it took me... at first it went very slowly, but then finally the last week or two before I had to bring it to the printer, it went very rapidly. And then over a long Whitsun weekend, my wife was typing the thesis for 4 or 5 days while I was writing the other chapters.
Typical graduate student story.
Yeah.
Well, what about the intermediate latitude survey? And that's a whole series of papers.
Yeah, it's funny, but much more has come out of that in publication than of my thesis work on Orion.
Yeah.
Possibly because these others, this intermediate latitude survey was a project in which I was involved together with other people, so that could not be delayed.
Yeah.
And it's been published in 4 installments. The first paper, together with Takakubo and Brass, giving the detailed profile atlas, together with an extensive description of instrument and reduction procedures, including the very detailed reduction procedures that we had developed at Groningen, including some discussion of the effects of stray radiation, so of radiation entering in the side lobes of the antenna. Takakubo, this was published also in 62, when I had just left for the States. In fact, I sent it to the printer before I went. Takakubo had been working on the analysis of it, and a second paper about the Gaussian components with the with an extensive table of Gaussian components of all the profiles was published by Takakubo and me together. That got rather delayed because it was written by Takakubo in somewhat poor English. There was a lot of discussion also about what the contents really should be. So while I was in the States, I worked on that paper, wrote to him about it, and then visited him in Japan. And again after that, it got delayed some more and finally came out in 66. And Takakubo's discussion of the properties of the components, their velocity dispersion comparison with interstellar absorption lines, the velocity field in the solar neighborhood, and various other things came out in 67, again after I had done an awful lot of work on it. Essentially, we've rewritten the whole paper at the expense of about 2 months.
But now, what do you think are the primary results from this all this intermediate latitude work?
I think it's given us very good information about the velocity properties of the clouds. It's given a good measure of the random motions in the interstellar medium, and also of the systematic motion, so a good determination of solar motion came out. And some indication of the velocity distribution, dispersion of 5 or 6 units a second, I think. Takakubo also determined the properties of clouds, let us say, radii, densities, and various things, assuming a model where all clouds would be spherical, homogeneous, and equal. And he applied that to the observations, assuming then that the observed distribution of column densities were not due to differences between the clouds, but were due to whether the cloud was fully or partly or not in the beam.
What about two clouds in the beam?
Two clouds overlapping in velocity would, of course...
So the assumption was that they would be...
thing was to find from the profiles which components could be trusted as being single. That was hard at low latitudes, 10 or 15 degrees. It could be done quite well at 20 or 25. And he assumed essentially that column densities below a certain limit would be single, and above a certain limit not. And then from the distribution of column densities, he derived the average angular size of clouds. I've always thought that was quite hairy. In this case, starting from a simple model and then making the quite specific assumption that the distribution of NH would be determined by the relative location of a cloud with respect to the antenna beam, you would get results out that might have some bearing on the average properties of clouds, but would not be fully representative. That's my personal opinion.
Now, the only previous work that had been done, I guess, was at DTM, is that correct? And high-latitude surveys, out-of-the-plane surveys?
That was far higher latitude, very wide grid, and they have not discussed it in terms of real cloud properties. Oh, I should add that what was really new in our study at intermediate latitudes was, of course, the internal motions in clouds, because nothing was known about those so far, except very little bit from the interstellar absorption lines. There were data known for the motions of clouds as a whole with respect to each other, and they were confirmed by us. As I said, velocity distribution with a dispersion of maybe 6 kilometers a second. But how narrow or wide are the profile components that belong to an individual cloud? That was not known. And of course, that is influenced by blending. So you can only find upper limits in principle. But the statistics of these things, well, they range between 1 and 7 kilometers a second, the dispersions. But they indicated that 2 or 3 was a representative number, which was later confirmed in more detailed studies by myself in Orion, together with Schwartz, and at other places like Nanuloditer at high latitudes with quite a narrow band, work by Carl Hylus, other work by us here. And I think that was one of the important results.
But the DTM people never published their stuff very much, did they?
They published their high latitude survey, all right, in Astronomical Geology.
Well, that was pretty complete.
Yeah, that's the full profile atlas. But they didn't analyze it much. That's all. Harry Helfer only made an analysis of the velocity field in the solar neighborhood where he derived the a vector or tensor for the field, which I can't remember in detail. Rather difficult paper.
So I guess it's only the low latitude surveys that were only recently sort of announced that they are available to anyone that wants them. Wasn't that in AJ? There was a very short article by two.
Yes, that's a very new survey made by two.
New?
Oh yes, a very new survey by two made in the last few years.
Oh, I thought that it was 10 or 15 years old.
No. No, not at all.
Oh, that was my memory. I'm sure he said in there.
No, I've been there in 71, and I found out that he was in the process of writing up a new survey of the essentially all sky, but with a wide grid, rather, although not so wide as the earlier one, and quite narrow in at low latitudes.
Okay, that's my mistake. That's much later than the history, as I defined it anyway.
I think I should add that during those years in which I was working on my doctor's thesis, in addition to the work on the intermediate latitude survey, I've also been working together with Margarita Huck on some hydrogen clouds which are below H and Chi Persei. There were two objects of quite high velocities, minus 26 and minus 48 kilometers a second, about 10 degrees south of H and Chi Persei, which for those velocities was rather striking, at least at that time. And
these were found how, accidentally? Or?
They were found by accident in the Indian Intermediate Latitude Survey. And then a detailed grid was taken over something like 15 by 15 degrees of the sky, which at that time was quite considerable, a number of observations. We discussed that material in terms of, the detailed velocity field and structure in those two clouds, and I've done considerable work on their possible relationship to the association, possible explosive processes which have driven those clouds out, and what their history might have been. And that work also was complete at the time I went to the United States, and I gave a colloquium about it at Caltech, and met with so much opposition on one hand. I said that we needed 300 supernovae to drive all that gas out of the association. It's really 20 supernovae that you need to drive it all out, but it's only a small cone, so you would need 300
going all over
to cover all the solid angles. And I also had made calculations showing that in a super association of this kind, around H and Kuiper's, right, as observed, one could indeed expect 300 supernovae. Now, I met with a lot of opposition and many constructive remarks, people telling me, look into this, look into that, look into that.
Yeah.
Which I took to heart, but then it took a lot of time to do all this, and I was there basically to do my great survey of interstellar absorption lines in stars in various associations. So I never got around to finishing it off, and the work still remains unpublished.
And when you came back, you just got involved in other things. So.
Yeah, there were so many other things to do, like teaching and taking care of the personnel of the lab.
Well, and you were still working on the intermediate... That
I was still working on, together with
papers.
Dr. Kubo, sure.
And Schwartz, I guess, was also part of it then, or was it?
Schwartz took part in the work on the intermediate latitudes. In particular, he made a new survey of a grid of 10 by 20 degrees. The first survey with the parametric amplifier in 1963, which he has used to make the most detailed analysis of profile components and cloud structure to date.
Right, and he developed the procedure for the Gaussian analysis.
Gaussian analysis, that's not fully true. He developed an analysis for relating Gaussian components in various positions on the sky. So compare the components of a profile to those at neighboring positions.
Oh, yeah.
And do that on a quantitative basis and then classify components into groups, which you then call a cloud. And that has been done by him on a numerical basis, which I think is a very good one. And that's a development by him alone. The procedures for analyzing profiles into Gaussian components, which of course have been developed at several places, more or less independently, around 1960, I would say, by Lindblad and by Gernstein and Bohm, and by people in the States.
Mm-hmm.
In our case, it was suggested to us by Blau, to Brass and me, that we should do a thing of that sort. It was suggested by Blau independently. One thought at that time that internal motions of clouds would probably be Gaussian, and so the idea was to take a profile and try to fit Gaussian components in. And we took this to the Computing Institute of Berlin University in the beginning of 59, maybe February or March. They had just acquired the first electronic computer at Groningen.
TR-4?
No. This was a Zebra, a Dutch design.
I see.
Which also existed at Utrecht and at Delft, I think. I'm not sure about Utrecht. There were a few in our country, various places. And this looked like an interesting problem for those people to work on. So a young graduate student there, Hans Kaper, developed the first program, and we got it on the computer in the spring of 59. And we had a lot of problems originally that simple profiles worked and complicated profiles did not, because then you got a divergence in the procedure. I found the forum, the professor of applied mathematics was very interested and spent long hours at the computer together with us to get the proper fits.
The CypherCommer lasted a good bit longer, even after that computer was here, though, didn't it?
The CypherCommer, yes.
It took a while to switch over, apparently.
Of course. The big computing, like the Gaussian analysis, was never done by the CypherCommer. It could only be done by the Zebra and later the TR-4. But the routine reduction of observations, which required first digitizing the data at the receiver, and then having programs for all the various corrections to be made, that remained hand done till 1961. In 61, Dringelow was digitized, and Ernst & Moore had developed computer programs to do reductions on the X1, which was available in The Hague, and these computer programs were essentially based on the procedures for hand reduction that Whitney Shane and I had developed at Leiden. The CypherCommer continued in use for still quite some time to handle older observations and also some of the new ones, and it has gradually petered out. And there were two old people who retired in the 60s, and of the younger ones, Hausmann got involved in handling the Zebra computer.
I see.
Immediately in 59. He spent many hours in the day or evening to do Gaussian components. Zeidema first went into the army, and when he came back, he did an awful lot of hand reduction for us. Later, a couple of years ago, he was turned into a programmer.
And Leiden had a similar CypherCommer, I suppose.
Yes, it always had. Yeah. The astronomical institutes in our country always had such things. Yeah. And many other places, too.
Oh, yeah, sure. Everyone had to have something like this.
Yeah.
I'm just interested on the transition stage between them. Well, we're up to about 65, I think, which is sort of where I'm cutting off this history.
I guess so, yeah.
It gets, sort of out of hand at that point. Mm-hmm. This is a bit on the end of the tape here. Can you think of anything, general comments that you...
Yeah, I have not really...
Perhaps over the Paris Symposium, any impressions about that meeting?
Okay, Paris Symposium. I got an invitation to come there to give a talk about about my work in the Orion region, which was a 20-minute paper. It was one of, I think, a total of about 90 papers in that symposium. It was a very big meeting, close to 200 people. But as it is said, it was the last meeting where essentially all radio astronomers were present.
Right.
It was my first one, I found it rather difficult. It was a very big meeting, as I say. It was hot in Paris in the summer. It was a rather dull room in a basement somewhere, where you... With insufficient ventilation and was sometimes difficult to hear the speakers. It was, of course, there was a lot of interesting stuff there. What struck me most, I think, at the symposium was the grave disagreement between Ryle and his people and Mills on the other side, on the source counts. And it later turned out that Ryle was indeed wrong, which, of course, is rather amazing.
Yeah, that's about the only time he's been wrong, actually, yeah.
I think this was the counts of the T2C survey.
The 2C survey, right, mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, that's the whole story in itself, of course.
Yeah.
But apparently you didn't have the impression then of a group of old friends getting together, and it got a little bit too big by that time.
Of course, it was obvious to me that many of the people there knew each other because they'd seen each other at earlier meetings. In 55 at Jodl Bank and the Earthsea assemblies, probably various other opportunities. I was a newcomer, and I could very well feel that I was not really part of the in crowd, but there were many, many people, so the effect was
there were a lot of newcomers.
I think so,
probably.
Yeah, there must have been.
Yes. Yeah, that's probably right, even though it was the last time that everyone got together that maybe half the people there was the first time they'd actually been in radio astronomy.
Quite possible.
Yeah. And that was indeed the last meeting that's been called just radio astronomy also, I think.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. The next IAU symposia concerned with part of radio astronomy, where I would say the one in 63 about the Magellanic, the galaxy and the Magellanic clouds to some extent.
Right.
And then in 66, the NORTRAC symposium on radio astronomy and the galactic system, which had then been highly specialized.
Right.
I wouldn't leave.
So you couldn't have Ryle and Mills there arguing.
In fact, Ryle was one of the members of the organizing committee, but he didn't come.
I see.
And Mills did come and gave a paper about halos in galaxies, but that was only a small thing. Of course, that NORTRAC symposium is quite a different story again. That is after 65. It's one of the major things that I've done in radio astronomy, I would think.